Hey, welcome back, everybody, to episode 59 of my podcast. And today's episode is also brought to you by ProBalls.com. ProBalls.com is a statistical platform that features over 75 leagues around the world. And if you're a statistical nerd and like to research some crazy things from players and their past, their career, there's some very neat searches on there that you can find, obviously, their career highs, career lows, but also their teammate search I find very interesting. And I also always like to quiz my guests on their teammates that they had in the past. So if you're a statistical nerd, please go up to ProBalls.com and check out that platform. Thank you very much. And today's guest is none other than Anthony Goods. Anthony Goods is a good friend of mine and honestly felt like we've known each other forever. But I'm sure he gives off that vibe to a lot of people just because of how easy it is to talk to him. And today we talked about his life as a scout on the road, not necessarily him scouting for the Detroit Pistons, but more so the lifestyle and the routine that he has on the road. We talked about his path as a player from the G League to Europe, back to the G League, back to Europe, played in Israel, France. At the end of the day of his career, he played in Kosovo, also played in Venezuela, and told a crazy story in from his time in Venezuela, how he got kidnapped. So you have to listen to that one. And then we talked about his other passion, which is Swiss cultures, and it aligns with his regular job very much so. And he talked about how he founded it, how much passion goes into it, how he sees content basically everywhere. And he's just a very fascinating figure to talk to and talk about life, talk about different topics about life. And I really urge you to listen to this one. It's very interesting. And it was just an easy chat with Anthony Goods. Thanks for being here. Bye. Anthony, what's up, my man?
Man, what's happening, B? How you doing?
Thanks for coming on. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate you opening the doors for, you know, me, a lonely guy like myself, you know, foreign land.
Lonely guy, man. We gotta talk about the loneliness on the road. That's one of the things. We're two NBA scouts, making the rounds around the world and going through in and out of hotel rooms, and we're gonna get to that. But I wanted to first start off with, how is your life after getting robbed? Are you getting back everything in line? The passport situation, everything is getting cleared.
Yeah. I got my passport. My last step is getting my Spanish visa back. So I got to kind of go through that process, like not completely from scratch, but like halfway through. So I have to go through a couple more meetings and to get another one. But everything else is fine. I got my passport, got my credit cards, got a new cell phone, new backpack. I mean, they got everything, you know what I mean? So
Tell the people what happened when you were in Barcelona.
Yeah, man. So I just went to the beach in Barcelona, because who doesn't go to the beach? But I just like to run. I don't get in the water. So I went for a run and I had my backpack in the trunk. I was actually on my way to go to a game after. And then I came back. Window was busted. It's funny because I opened the trunk and I didn't see my bag, and I'm like, am I in the wrong car? Like, you know, something's off. I'm like, what car is this? Like, somebody just left the trunk open? And then I look and saw the side window was broken. And they stole my bag. So, you know, I saw them find my iPhone, that all my belongings were on the north side of town. So I kind of went on a manhunt, and then had to cut that short, go to police office, file a report, and spent a couple more hours manhunting and didn't find anything. So, then I just started making plans to head back to the States so I could get a new passport.
Chalked it up to the game, huh?
Yeah, charged it to the game, man. It's Barcelona, man. That's they say. It's funny, man. Coming from the States, you know, we have an arrogance. You know, Americans, we just think, we know our country's crazy. So because of that, you hear so much crazy stuff. We think that, like, other places aren't as dangerous or whatever it may be. And everybody's telling me, oh yeah, they steal a lot in Barcelona and stuff like that. I'm just like, you know, I'm pretty careful. Yeah. One day they catch you slipping, man.
Yeah. That sunny day turned dark real quick.
man, I was hot. I was hot, but, I, you know.
I know that feeling because I had a similar situation. It was just in Moscow when my first. It was actually my first 2 weeks on a job, maybe. And okay. I was like this naive kid coming from a small town, coming into a big city, and I always like I always grew up in a really secure environment, safe. Nobody ever robbed me. I did have instances in teenager years where I got robbed, not at gunpoint, but with a like behind the jacket, some knife or something. Mm-hmm. It was just kind of so that was a scary moment when I was young, but that was in person. This one in Moscow was just kind of like I put my backpack behind my I put it from the front of the car to the back of the car, right behind my chair. Mm-hmm. And kind of like I was cognizant of that, so somehow I felt like okay, I'm not gonna leave it out there for everybody to see, but it's still in the back. And somebody was in a truck behind me in the van, in the yellow van, and they saw me putting the bag behind it, I guess. And I registered it afterwards. I just kind of put things together because I was walking by and I saw these two dudes sitting in this van, kind of, and I just kind of like, it was shady, but I was like, okay, maybe they're just sitting in the van on the phone because they were just kind of had this phone open. And I walked around with the assistant coach, walked around the corner to have some lunch and grabbed some lunch actually to go. So it was like a 5 minute, just a quick get. And I'm coming back and the electronic lock, like the one that you use with the beeper, you know, just, it didn't work. It was kind of like, it was stuck. It was just, it's not opening. It's not, there's no signal, nothing. And I get to my car and I see through the window and the backpack is not there. I'm like, oh no. Like then the feeling when you don't have to, like it's gone and you feel like you've been robbed. You like, you know, you've been robbed. You're like, that's the worst feeling. It's just kind of like, what happened? You just this panicky, this adrenaline starts coming up. You just don't know what's going on. And I had to open the door with the key itself, old school style. And then the alarm went off. So I knew something was off with electronics. So they told me later that they usually lock the signal through a phone. That's why that's why I registered when I saw those two guys on the phone in the van. They locked, they blocked my signal from blocking the door. And then when they went in and opened it up, and then somehow they locked the door back up with the signal. I don't know how they did it, but and then it was kind of a clean robbery, but a quick one. And they were really professionals. That's all. My laptop was gone. My scouting reports that I was working on were gone. Everything was gone. Yeah. Luckily. And it's, imagine I went to Tesco and I was like, this is my first 2 weeks in the job, and I lose everything. I look like a fool. And Jared Holden was there. Luckily, somebody from the States was coming at that time, and they brought me a new laptop. And I had sent one scouting report out to a friend to take a look at it, you know, just to have in a database. I had one in my folder in an email outbox, and that was the one that I used to rebuild everything from. It was just kind of like, man, that it was so much work, but it was something that. The thing itself that you get robbed, that's the scary part. That's really odd.
Yeah, for sure. And I felt like, I don't know if you felt the same way, but I don't know if I could call it survivor's guilt, but like afterwards I was thinking about like every candy bar I stole as like a little kid. Like I don't even believe in karma, but you just have all these thoughts. Yeah. You don't have anything else to do. And it's like, what did I do to deserve this?
Yeah, you know? Everything is coming back at you right now. I did steal some candy when I was young. When I was real young, I was like eight years old. And I told my mom that because I was so innocent. I told my mom I stole some candy. And she's like, what are you doing? You're crazy. In Germany, we just moved to Germany. Like, Mom, I'm just gonna share it with this girl. I stole it for that girl. I was like the romantic stealer when I was. So today we're gonna talk about a little bit about scouting life, just the in and out of in and outs of our job. Then we're gonna go a little bit about your playing career because you had a pretty interesting path that was going through different cultures, and I'm curious about how you adapted and adjusted and what mindset you went into it while you're moving from country to country. And then we're going to go into the afterlife, which is afterlife is kind of the scouting life right now, but the creative life that we're both living right now, of how we balance and you've particularly balanced all the projects that you got going on. But starting off with the scouting, the in and out of the hotel rooms, the finding a routine, the getting from country to country, from flight to flight, hopping on and off, people don't really recognize or understand of how strenuous it can be. But I was wondering, how do you schedule yourself ahead of time? How do you prepare yourself for the trips? And you know that you're gonna, like, do you look to find a routine? Because there's in our job, not hardly ever 2 days alike. So it's kind of like we have to find a way to manage ourselves, manage our health, manage our workouts, manage somehow our job while we're on the road and work on the plane. How do you deal with everything and how do you go about it?
Yeah, usually, I mean, I do try to block off my days. So usually I try to watch games and everything either in the morning or at night. So obviously if there's games like last night, you know, there was like Euro Cup games and things of that nature. So I'll watch games at night. And then in the morning, if I need to catch up on something, whether it be an NBA game or whatever it may be, I usually try to watch that like first thing in the morning. Like I'll slide it in my bed, you know, even before I'm up, because I don't really need to be sitting on at a table for that. So I do that, you know, if I'm home, and then I try to work out, and then I start getting into more of my creative work, usually like early afternoon, maybe even early evening. But usually I try to save early evening for phone calls or whatever I might need to do. So I usually try to keep up with that routine. If I'm traveling, back when I had an iPad, RIP, or when I had an iPad, I would download games and keep them on my iPad, because I'm very much the type of person, I try to take advantage of every moment that I have. So even when I used to like live in California, I used to drive a lot, right? And I used to spend like 4 hours a day on the road, 4 to 6 hours a day, I'd just be driving, just because LA is just crazy. So I decided, my homeboy was like, yo, turn your car into a classroom. So I would turn on like podcasts, or I would try to like learn things while I was in the car, at least two hours of the day. You know what I'm saying? So I was doing that every day. So now when I'm traveling, I think it's best if I download a game, put it on my iPad, and you know, I don't sleep much on planes. So I'll try to watch a game while I'm on a plane, and I can still listen to music. I can do, you know, everything else I'll be normally doing, but instead of staring at the ceiling, I'm watching a game. And then obviously, you know, you land, take a nap, head over to the game, and do dinner if you have to, and then, you know, go home. But that's kind of the schedule. I try to think of my days in blocks, especially because I'm so tied to the United States. And I know my first half of my day, nobody's really bothering me because the state's asleep. Yeah. So I really try to get the important stuff done, you know, in that first half of the day.
You work out in the hotels?
No, I like to work out outside. So as long as it's not super cold, because I don't like traveling with a lot of clothes, as long as it's not super cold, I'll go run somewhere. And, you know, I'll do push-ups on a park bench or on the street. Like, you know, I get in
that prison workout in.
Hey, for real, I'll do pull-ups on a tree branch if it's out there. I did too. You know, I'll do all that. Like, I don't care. I'll probably look crazy outside, but I just prefer to be outside, you know, get some sun, get some fresh air. Spend enough time in the house sitting at a chair. So it's like, why not go work out outside? And that's kind of what I got into. Just even in my playing career, I had a trainer. We used to always work out outside, and we never touched weights. We was always push-ups, pull-ups and stuff. So I just kind of carried that on.
Interesting. So you still do the just body weight workouts?
Yeah. I don't touch a weight for real. Unless it's like raining outside or snowing and I'm in the gym, but I'm still going to be doing push-ups and pull-ups. But I rarely touch weights. I just kind of get the body weight workouts, man.
And interesting.
And sculpt this physique you see before you.
I'm in a good vibe right now in terms of working out, but I do use weights, and it kind of feels like maybe my body is too light. Is that the push-ups are not interesting in it? I don't know.
No, I got a workout for you.
All right.
I got a workout. So I used to train. So my first year out of school, I hurt my hip. So I was out like pretty much the whole year for like 9 months. So I started training at this boxing gym. They were super cool. They started letting me work out with the pros when the pros would come, like early afternoon. So I started working out with the trainers. And then, so, you know, boxers, like, That's some of cardio. Them don't really need to put on, yeah, they don't really need to put on mass, and they train a whole different way. Yeah. So it was kind of cool. But I got with one of their trainers, and he used to make us go through this push-up routine where you max out as many push-ups as you can, right? This is the first rep, as many as you can. So let's say you get 30, 40, 50, whatever it is. Then you rest like literally like 3 seconds, 3 to 5 seconds, get one. Because it's going to be a struggle, right? You just maxed out, so you get one. Then you rest 3 to 5 seconds, you get two. And it's kind of like a pyramid. You go all the way up to 10, all the way back down to one. So it's like 200 and something push-ups, but it's like your biceps are like...
It pumps.
Everything is crazy. Everything is about to explode. So that's one that I kind of throw in there. But I mean, there's a lot of ways to make things challenging, and usually it just has to do with muscle fatigue. So like, even if you're doing body weight squats, like do 100 body weight squats. First of all, you're going to be tired if you even get to 100, and then just reduce, you know, the time in between sets, and now go get 20 and then do 20 more. And then you'll slowly, you'll quickly start to feel it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So there are ways to do body weight workouts and make them challenging.
I did a lot of, you know, like bicep, then you go into a different set, like just the I don't know, diamond. I think the diamond push-ups.
Yeah, diamond push-ups, yeah.
Jay-Z push-ups, you can call it Jay-Z. then I did the tricep push-ups where you do it tight. So I was going back and forth. And I do the warm-up sometimes with the how you call the jumping jacks. You do the one jumping jack, one push-up, two jumping jacks, two push-ups, three jumping jacks, three push-ups. You go all the way up, like you said, a pyramid to 10. If in the early on, you're not going to get 10 and then go all the way down to one. So you might want to start with going up to 6 and then down. And then after a couple of weeks, maybe to 8 and then down. And then, so that's a good warm-up. It gets my whole body going. And then I go into my, I do some rubber band workouts. I do like rubber band workouts and something for my legs, for my upper body, just kind of, try to get the deep tissue muscles going somehow.
Yeah, no, it's all great stuff, man. And I'm thankful because, you know, I think a lot of people feel like they can't work out unless they're at a gym. And, you know, I'm thankful. My trainer back in the day, Frank Matriciano, he's a close friend of mine. So like we were training, like, I don't know if you remember the ESPN did a docuseries called The Rookie with Blake Griffin. So Blake and I were coming out the same year. So like Blake and I, we were doing pre-draft with Frank. And so we're running up sand dunes, carrying like 70-pound like sandbags and doing all these squats and push-ups and pull-ups and stuff at like a kid's park. And ESPN was there, you know, they were filming for like 3 or 4 days. But and then Frank, he always wears a mask when he's on TV. So like he was on his like crazy Frank. Gilbert Arenas been talking about him on ass and stuff. But, you know, I was really thankful. Obviously, back then I was in terrific shape. But I was really thankful because it showed me that, like, I just need space. Like, I just need a living room. I need a hallway. You know what I mean? And, you know, I can get a quality workout, at least for me.
That's those outside workouts on the hill. Like, I had in high school, I went to a high school in the States that was in the South in Louisiana. It was a football school. And they had this hill that they ran on. You know, it was a little bit steeper on one side. It was a little bit flatter on the other side. And we, with the basketball team, had to do it too. But then, like, it was called, you know, like the hill, like the hill. Right. So, and we would start working out. We started practices in October. And then if you mess up, if you, like, instead of running suit size, like, go outside and run that hill. Like, no. Like, that was the thing that you really try to avoid at all costs. You know, that was the biggest punishment. But that outside workouts, and you can always come up in nature, you can find a whole bunch of tools to really get you going. I'm creative too. Like, I see a bench, I start doing some hopping on the bench, some sit-ups or some not lunge, would you I'm blanking on the word. Squats, just like body weight squats. Yeah. Trying to help myself just to bump back up. But yeah, you can get creative with it.
Yeah, sure.
How do you balance personal life with life on the road? Like, I know you're going between the States and Europe a lot, and then you're trying to stay in touch with the American side. Then in Europe, I'm sure you have friends and a lot of acquaintances from when you were playing. So. Mm-hmm. How do you go out and see people that you like and still not forget to work, and vice versa? Because the social life is it's gotten more important. I'm more cognizant of it than I was 5-6 years ago when I was just kind of oblivious to it. I was, you know, so into, you know, just work. And now I'm kind of like, the personal life is kind of, it's a big thing. And that's probably the main thing. And I don't know how to, maybe you can update me on your, how you go about it.
Yeah. Honestly, like I don't have much of a social life. Like I don't, things get busy. It depends on the time of year. You know what I mean? I think that, I think this time of year, obviously with the amount of video studies and all that other stuff, like I'm not gonna have much of a social life at all, but I don't sleep well at night. So because of that, I'm up. Like this morning, I was up at 5 a.m. when you text me earlier. Yeah. I'm up at 4 a.m., 5 a.m. I don't sleep much. So it's like, I need to rest. And a lot of times after I travel and I come home, I don't want to go out. I don't want to go to restaurants and all that other stuff, like, because I've been there. So it's like my social life kind of exists on the road. Like, you know, I see, you know, guys from other teams or whoever, you know what I mean? I get to talk to them either at the game or at dinner or whatever it may be. When I'm home, it's funny. I got a friend here in Madrid and he's like, I only see you at the games. And we live like 15 minutes away, because it's like, when I come home, I need like 2 days to just chill. Yeah. And then after 2 days, I'm traveling again. So it's like, you know, it's tough. But yeah, I mean, there are times like, yeah, because I don't like going to clubs and stuff like that. Maybe if somebody's in town, we'll go to a bar or whatever. But usually I just like to go to restaurants if I'm doing anything socially. Yeah. But yeah, like honestly, it's usually like twice, 2-3 times a month that I do something socially, like here in Madrid. Most of my social activities is on the road. And then when I come home, I'm very much a homebody in the house. I work out, talk on the phone with my friends and family back home and just catch up back there. And that's about it.
Yeah, that's, but you have a fiance, right? If I'm not missing.
Yeah.
So how do you deal with that on being on the road? How often you communicate to balance out the relationship part? Because that's where a lot of people struggle with that. All day.
If I can. I mean, she works, you know, obviously 9 to 5 and stuff. So we usually talk in the morning before she goes to work. And then we, you know, if I'm up late, then, you know, I'll talk to her like after the game. But, you know, we'll text throughout the day, depending on the day. And I think that in regards to relationships, you know, I think everybody just has to figure out, you know, what style of, how much communication and what type of communication you and your partner needs, you know what I mean? So it's like, it differs from person to person. Some people may be texters, some people may be on the phone, some people may like the FaceTime. I personally hate FaceTime. It's on, like, and you guys gotta kind of figure what that is as a couple. But because of that, I've been flying home to Miami once a month. Any free, like, I'm back on that bird going to Miami. So it's I've been getting a lot of miles in this year. So that's the best way to kind of balance it. But yeah, man, I think the social aspect, I mean, and again, it's different. But I will tell you this, when I first moved to Madrid, I thought it was going to be cool, just like when I was playing overseas and like, oh, I know all these players here, there, whatever it is. And I quickly realized the difference now versus when I was a player is like, as a player, I had practice every day. I was touching base with guys every day, like my teammates and, you know, and more specifically, even my American teammates. So you got that touch of home every single day, whether you wanted it or not, you was going to get it.
Right? Yeah.
You know, and it was, like, quickly, no, here. Like, I would go days without seeing people, you know what I mean? Seeing somebody I knew like that. So that was an adjustment. But I mean, I think now, like, you know, you adjust and you get more comfortable. And then obviously just staying helps as well. So yeah, man, we're all different though, man. And we all got different needs at different times of the year too.
Yeah, this. Seasons within seasons, I like to call it. There's a lot of, you know, there's ups and downs. Everybody's dealing with something. At some time, you need more social life. Sometimes you want to be a little bit secluded. There's it's different for everybody, like you said. And I think for me, it became a little bit more, I wouldn't say a top priority, but it is, it's gotten more important that when I'm in Vilnius, for example, during this season, I like to get in touch with people. I like to go, yes, like, let's go walk. I have this one friend that we always just kind of walk around at night and we go and go maybe to a bar, just talk about life and talk about the things that are going on, just to kind of have this, you know, you have a person that you really can connect with. You kind of also want to hang out more with them. And it's naturally, it gives a good balance and a good, you know, alternative to work, you know, because when my mind is always on basketball, you can drive yourself crazy as well. So that's why we also, I'm sure we, that's also why we're doing the creative parts, because it kind of gets your blood flowing a different way, in a different direction, in different ways. It just kind of, it's a different stimulus.
Yeah. Yo, I got a question. I was talking to somebody the other day. Do you think you could be an introvert and be a scout?
It would require, some work, but I think you can. You just have to get up for those moments. You wouldn't be able probably to network as well. I hate to call it network, because it's not a network. It's more like Mike Schmidt said it the best when he was saying, it's more creating friendships. Like, you're trying to create friendships on the road. You're trying to create friendships within the business, and those become then your allies to a degree, right? So you're making friends on the road. So naturally, if you're an introvert, it depends of how you normally make friends. It might not be just a cold approach, but within the group, you kind of warm up to people as time goes on. And then it just would take a little bit longer, I think, to get acquainted with that person and build that network out and build that trust out. You know, some people are more introverted. I'm definitely not. I wouldn't say I'm completely introverted, but depending on the situation, I'm more on that side of the spectrum, like above average to high. But it also, like, and I like to share personal stuff, because that's how I connect. I don't mind to reach out and talk about my life, talk about my problems, and then you show the first step, you make the first step, the other person is going to realize that you're really open up, you're being vulnerable, and then they're going to open up. It's going to build a relationship much easier. And I build friends around the world that way, because that's how I make friends in regular life. That's how I, you know, in cafes, I just talk, I see something, I talk to random people. Most people won't do it. That's an introverted versus outroverted person. And from that, things can evolve. But introverted people in the scouting business is just going to take a little bit longer period to expand that network and to get comfortable, because those people have to feel a sense of security, of, you know, just not the fear of putting yourself out there, get overcoming that. So it's going to take a bit. I think it's possible. It's just going to take a little bit more work.
Yeah. I think it's possible, but you definitely, I think it best, if you're going to be an introvert, you have to be an extroverted introvert, if such a thing exists. You got to be able to take yourself out of that and go talk to a stranger and then deal with rejection and deal yep. with people not responding or not yep. wanting to talk to you, and then, you know, just brush it off and not think twice about it. But I always think it's just interesting looking at the different positions in basketball, because a lot of people always talk to me about the transition to basketball, like, you know, what can I do? What do I want to do? And I think a lot of it really depends on, you know, your personality type and, you know, the lifestyle you want to live. Like, do you want to be on the road, or do you want to kind of be tied down to a specific city, or do you want to just work from where you live now? Like, you know, all those things make a difference when choosing a path.
100%, 100%. Everybody needs to find their own path of what you want. And it took a while for me to figure it out, because at some point, and we're going to talk about the retirement part, because that's the thing that you create a new identity. Basically, you have to find yourself, rediscover yourself. And hopefully, as you were approaching retirement, you learn to find new hobbies. You learn maybe to find different ways. So what stimulates you at the next level, so you can prepare yourself for the next stage, because it's not everybody. If you stop cold turkey, it can be tough. I mean, you can deal with a whole bunch of things. But that we said about rejection, there's one thing that I listened to a podcast earlier, and I keep hearing this 100 days of rejection. Have you heard about it? Mm-mm. It's rejectiontherapy.com. If you just type in Google 100 days of rejection, then this is gonna the first thing that's gonna pop up. And rejection number one, borrow $100 from a stranger. Rejection number two, request a burger refill. Three, ask for Olympic symbol donuts. Deliver pizza for Domino's. Have a tour in a grocery store warehouse. Play soccer in someone's backyard. Speak over Costco's intercom. So just kind of do crazy stuff that you put yourself out there. You that's 99 of the times you're going to get rejected. But you kind of go through those difficult moments of being rejected, and you start dealing with rejection maybe a little bit better and get comfortable with approaching people. So that could be a good tool to get people going over the hump a little bit.
Yeah. No, it's funny, man, because I remember I read when I was in college, I had an older friend that was playing overseas, and he told me about this book. It was written by this pickup artist named Neil Strauss. Mm. And he's like, yo, read this book. And it's written by a pickup artist. I'm like, man, I already get girls. He's like, nah, it's just going to take it to another level. So I was like, all right, man, I read the book. And then it was really insightful, and not even just about like getting women. It was really just about communication. And like, you know, in one of his books, he was talking about how like, okay, if you don't feel comfortable just approaching someone, or, you know, if you have that fear inside of you, like warm up throughout the day, just like an athlete warms up before a game. So go to the store, ask somebody what time it is. You know what I mean? Even though you already know the time, just ask somebody what time it is. Then, you know, go ask somebody what time it is, and then ask one more question, like, okay, how do you get to the nearest Starbucks? And then, like, you know, just slowly start to warm yourself up. So that way, by the time, you know, the evening comes, you've talked to like five strangers already. Mm-hmm. You're going to be mm-hmm. a little more comfortable by the time you had that first date or whatever it may be. So, you know, I think that, you know, communicating, you know, is a lot like, you know, anything else. You know, we got to get comfortable with rejection, and like anything, to get good at anything, you have to practice. So practice getting rejected, practice talking to strangers. I think all those skills are really important.
Yeah, that's one thing with when I never was the one to approach and to have that first interaction because of that. I always used to be, it's gotten better. That's definitely gotten better. But I used to be really bad with that. I was really reluctant, and I'm probably missed out on a lot of opportunities or crutches that I had that maybe they had on me too. You know, like, who knows? Mm-hmm. You kind of miss on those opportunities. But once you get going, I feel more comfortable talking. But for some reason with women, I was always a little bit more reluctant because of that rejection part. I just kind of not was never used to it, and I felt more comfortable with strangers that I had no interest in, just talking and making a fool out of myself. But at the same time, I was not capable of approaching a woman and saying what I think.
Yeah, I think a lot of guys struggle with not knowing what to say mm-hmm. to a woman. And mm-hmm. I think that the exact thing and process that you're thinking sometimes, like, that is probably the best thing to say. So it's like, oh man, I see this beautiful girl, I don't know what to say. You could literally go up to her and just be like, excuse me, I don't have a lot of time. I can't even think of anything to say, but I really just wanted to introduce myself, because if I left and I didn't, I wouldn't be able to forgive myself, you know, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. And that, it's like, it shows humility. It shows vulnerability. And a lot of times, even if whether she's interested or not, that's out of your control. But, you know what I mean? I think even just saying, you know, something as simple as that is an easy way to open conversation with, you know, anybody, you know, just kind of just being real.
Weird topic, high demand women versus high demand players. Can you mm-hmm. compare the situations when you approach a woman versus approaching a high demand figure that is kind of looking at you like, what he's going to say? There's some judgment there. Is there not, no judgment? What do you, can you compare that? Or is that just a theory that I should throw out the window?
Nah, I mean, I think that theory holds, and I've always thought of it in the sense of, like, let's just say a woman that's a 10 and like a CEO, like a businessman. You know, I think all three scenarios, whether it's a CEO or a player or even a woman, I think a lot depends on the context in which you meet this person, where you meet this person, how you're approaching them, and then obviously what they're doing at the time, right? Like, if somebody's extremely busy, it doesn't matter who you are, you know what I mean? They'll brush you off. But I think that, so even going back to the book, so like even that pickup artist book, he used to call it negging, and that's pretty much like giving like a negative compliment, and you do that to kind of like lower somebody's self-esteem. But he would always talk about it and doing it in an unassuming or like humbling way, you know. So like he would talk about like it was kind of funny, he said like in a book he would take like he would keep like some lint in his pocket, and he would go up to like a really attractive woman, and he'd be like, oh, excuse me, you got this sitting on your shoulder, has that been there all day? And then obviously she's just like embarrassed that she has whatever the hell it is. It could be a piece of toilet paper or whatever. Yeah. Like she's embarrassed, but she's also thankful that you took it away. And you know what I mean? And now, you know, you have permission to approach. You know, but I always thought about it like, you know, if I was talking to, let's just say like a businessman, or I was talking to my friend the other day, I was like, yo, go get the most expensive gym membership there is at, I don't know, Lifetime Fitness or wherever it is. Go to the basketball court and go there to meet businessmen, because some businessmen like to play basketball, or even if you're at a bar watching the basketball game, the moment you say like, oh, I'm a scout for the Celtics, or I play basketball in college, or I've done this, you are already, you are the superior in the conversation. The chances are he did not. You know what I'm saying? So now his self-esteem is automatically lowered if you start conversation talking about that game. You know, and then you can transition into his field where he's a superior, and then things are a lot more easy to continue that conversation. So I think it's a little trickier with a player in approaching a player. And that's why I say that like context and where you guys meet and all that other stuff matters, because they get approached by people every day. And it's like to have to know or talk to one other person, it's like, what am I getting out of this for once? Because they're used to people taking from them. So it's like, what can you give that person, you know, in that moment? So, you know, that's where I always think it's good to try to make yourself seem like a peer if possible, or somehow elevate yourself by, you know, guiding conversation in a particular direction.
That's, I tell people all the time that, because they tell me like, man, players are so cold. And I said, they get a million requests. They have a million people that Dunbar's number of 150 does not apply to them. They have, they have so many things on their hands, and you got to understand them, that they're just getting approached nonstop. So I totally understand it. It's a protective mechanism that they try to also protect their kind of little bubble world, because I don't know if I want to live like that either. It's if you can't even go to a movie theater, you can't live regular life without being approached all the time and asked for a picture, for autograph, whatever it is. So it's kind of, I can see that being triggering and with the player at some point too. That's why he's just going to put on this wall and shield himself off to everybody who he doesn't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you think about it like this, like, I feel like we all have a certain amount of like social energy a day, right? So let's just say we got like $100 in ones, right? And every text message you get, you give out a dollar. Every text message during the day, you give out a dollar, you give out a dollar. You go speak to somebody outside, you give out a dollar. Somebody wants to talk to you, give out a dollar. You go to practice, every teammate, you give a dollar. Every coach, like by 3-4 o'clock, an NBA player, he's been through his 100, like, you know, throughout the day. Yeah. And it's like, you know, people don't really take that into consideration, just the mental drainage of just having to not seem like an asshole or not, you know what I mean, you know, try to protect your brand and your image when sometimes you just want to be ignored and I just want to walk to the store and come home, like, you know what I mean? But they don't have that luxury, man. I remember, so going back to Blake Griffin, I remember it was his second year in the league. I was getting ready to play in the G League. So like I had like a little bit of time, and I went to a Clipper game, and I talked to him. I talked to him after the game. This might've been his third year in the league. I talked to him after the game, and I was like, yo man, like, how's it been? And all this other stuff. He's like, it's cool, man. But it's like, it's different. I can't go nowhere. Mm-hmm. And I remember when he said that, man, I could see that, you know, cause Blake's he's a very welcoming guy, warm guy. He likes to joke around. But, you know, I could tell even way back then, man, it was kind of like, It was tough for him. It was an adjustment. It was a transition, I should say. You know, just not being able to do little things that you're used to doing. You know, you got to move different.
It was. I'm sure it can become a burden on some people, depending on the personality too. Even though you're, like you said, even though an inviting person and a person that's so open to new people, it can get draining or just too much. Kylian Mbappe, I think, said something like that too. He would pay a ridiculous amount. I don't. He maybe say it like he would pay whatever it takes to just live a normal life for 2 days, go out to the bakery, buy some croissants, drink a coffee, and just go about his life, you know, without being recognized. And that says a lot. You know, be careful if you're wishing to be famous. That's what Jim Carrey also said. I wish more people would become famous to understand that they don't want to be famous. You know, it's not about being famous. So
where do you think Mbappe could go and nobody would know who he is?
Tasmania.
Right.
I don't know.
Is there any like anywhere with like a city and civilization that like an Mbappe or a LeBron could
Tasmania
go?
Is not.
Is there anywhere they could go where, and I'm not talking about some Amazon island that's, you know, some tribal island. I'm talking about city that they could go and not be bothered. Cause I used to read about like Marvin Gaye. I think he used to go to, Belgium, you know, for a couple months, and he would just, because nobody would really bother him. He would get bothered a few times, like here and there, but for the most part, you know, and he would like grow his beard out and everything, and he'd just go to the beach or he would just go wherever, the cafes and stuff, and nobody would bother him, and he could just, you know, disconnect and create. But I wonder, for somebody like a LeBron or Mbappe, is there anywhere in the world they could go and just kind of blend in?
I think for Mbappe, maybe it's a little bit easier because of the size. Like LeBron just would stand out.
Yeah,
but
maybe
a civilization that's maybe not so congested, maybe Alaska. I've never been to Alaska, but it's just maybe in some parts of Alaska, we just kind of don't have such a congested area of people that in one place that are on top of each other all the time. Maybe just one of those countries or states where it may not be as prevalent. And the states, if you maybe he goes to Idaho or, you know, some state that is a little bit less in tune with the soccer culture, and you have still some
like
city
Wyoming.
Life.
Something like that.
Where it's a little bit less pop now. Soccer has become or European football. I mean, sorry for all the listeners. that where it's less prevalent and less of a civilization that's in tune with that culture, and you still have some sort of city life going on. So in one of those states in the U.S. and within the states in one of those cities, maybe.
Yeah. No. I think the States is probably one of the least interested countries in football or soccer.
Yeah.
From what I've seen, I think they're like, they said, it's football, baseball, or American football, baseball, basketball, ice hockey. A lot of these sports are ahead of soccer, as we call it. So, that's just, I don't know. That's a different lifestyle, man. I don't want it. I've always said, man, like, I'd never want to be famous. I'd rather have the connections. I'd rather have the access than the fame. Like, you know, and my friend and I used to always talk about it. Like, yo, like, I'd rather be Chad from the Neptunes. I don't want to be Pharrell. Maybe be the other guy.
Yeah, be the role player. Be the role player.
Just say, I'll do that. I'll set screens all day. I'm still on the team, baby.
Hey, they get rings too. They all get rings. We all get rings when we do. Sorry to all the Tasmanian listeners if I offended you for putting Tasmania on.
You ain't going to no jumping jackers games or whatever they're called. you ain't welcome. They got a nice atmosphere over there in Tasmania.
They do.
They sell out every game.
They are a basketball culture. That's why I was thinking that in that area it's just also so basketball oriented, or foot, probably footy as well. But it's Tasmania is a part of Australia It is very country. Like you go from city to city, there's a lot of countryside and a lot of nature out, you know, from going from one part of the city to from one city to another, from one part of Tasmania to another, it's a lot of emptiness. So it is kind of secluded. That's why was my initial thought. So I apologize to Tasmanian listeners if you are there. Let's go to probalos.com. That's one thing that I wanted to also test you on, but also see if you recognized any kind of let's see, I'll share my screen with you. You see it?
Yes, sir.
All right, so I'm gonna type in your name, and here you come up now. So if I go to teammates, I'm going to do a teammate search.
I like that. I'm 6'4". I grew in retirement. There we go. I grew in retirement.
Yeah. All those push-ups straighten out your back.
All right. That's what I'm talking about. 6'4". All right. Here we go.
All right. So if you had to guess, what was the most common teammate you had throughout your career? If you exclude Stanford from the list, because you were there for 4 years, so obviously there was a lot of,
Right.
So outside of Stanford teammates, which were the teammates you had the most interaction with or you played the most games with?
I would say John Cox, but it's either John Cox, Gil Amati, or maybe one of the G League guys, not Mikael Gladness, because the G League just had more games, I think.
Yeah. Was it a G League at that time, or was it still D League?
It was D League.
It was D League.
Yeah, it was D League.
So you see, the first nine were all Cardinals, and Mike Anderson is the one.
Yep, D League. I figured it was one of the D League guys because of the amount of,
and then you have the first European teammate was Ibrahima.
We played 39 games together. Well, I guess if they count cup games and stuff.
Yeah, I guess
it makes sense.
So if we go to your career, You played in various countries, and I was noticing that you had 4 years in the let's call it G League for now because it's G League now. So 4 years there, and then you went to Italy, then you went back to the G League for a year, Ukraine, Israel, France, Poland, Dominican,
Kosovo. They ain't even got Venezuela in there.
Venezuela
not in here. Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm gonna ask you about Venezuela, but I was wondering about this process of 4 years in the G, and then going to Italy, and then going back to the G. What was the process there? Did you feel like you were staying too long in the G League, or when did you decide to go over to Europe, and what made you go back to the G League?
Man, so everything. I'm going to just say a lot. It's funny because I've only played with one team for an entire season. I've always bounced around like my entire career, which is kind of crazy when you think, you know, I played, I don't know, it was 10, 11 years. But a lot of the issues, so like my first year in the G League, like I didn't play that many games. I was hurt. I knew I was hurt coming into the season, but I just didn't want to say anything. And I got an offer to go overseas. I was like, nah, I want to kind of stay home because I don't know how long I can make it. I don't want to go out there for 2 weeks. And then, so I went to the G League and I was having problems. So I just elected to get surgery. And then obviously no resume. I get back healthy a year later, got to go back to the G League. So that was 2010, 2011. And that's when I had that year with Dakota. So from there, after Dakota, that's when I first went to, that's the 2010, 2011 season. That's when I first went to, Venezuela because I didn't have any money. We were getting paid $13,000 in the G League. So by April, you know, season ends in April, that money gone by May. So in June, In June, I was out. And it's crazy, man, because, like, I remember, like, the next year when I came back to, when I came back to the D-League, I was talking to one of my teammates. I'm like, hey, bro, like, what you do during the summer? He's like, man, I was just selling weed. He's like, I ain't had no money. And, like, I felt him. Like, I was lucky enough to get a contract in Venezuela, and I went out there and played. But it was
That's crazy.
It's that tough, but, like, that's how, I mean, think about it. You're getting paid $13,000 over 6 months. Like,
yeah,
$13,000 over 6 months, kind of crazy. So, especially living in the States. But, so yeah, then I came back to the G League, 2011-2012. That was a lockout season. I went to training camp with OKC that year. Once they ended the lockout, I was the last cut there, and then I got an offer to go play in Teramo, and so I went to Teramo. I'd never seen that kind of money. I mean, we're talking like going from $13,000 to $120,000 to finish the season. I'm like, all right, baby. Like, I ain't never seen that kind of money. I'm buying a new PlayStation, a new controller. Like, brought my girlfriend with me. Like, what you want? You know what I'm saying? She getting all the new makeup. But yeah, and then I get there and then I don't get paid, man. They were in extreme financial trouble. They actually ended up folding that year. So I was there 2 months. It was a nightmare. I wasn't getting paid. And, you know, that was my first time in Europe, first time not getting paid. And I had already heard the horror stories. Yeah. So that's when I came home and I finished in the G League right there with the Mad Ants. And yeah, after I came back with the Mad Ants, I was like, all right, man, like, I can't keep doing this. Oh, I'm not making bread thing. So, like, let's just go overseas and quit chasing the league. So that was the whole mindset by there. So a lot of times when I ended up switching teams, don't get me wrong, there were times where I was just playing terrible and I got cut a couple times, but there were also a few times where the money went bad. Like in Ukraine, the money went bad. You know, they didn't have enough money to pay us, so they let us out of our contract, so I had to leave. You know, in Poland, the money went bad. Like, there's just a lot of places where things just didn't work out, or you just end up getting into it. And Galil, me and the new coach, we bumped heads from the very first day. And they ended up working out a transfer for me to go back to Messina. So different things happened over the course of my career. But I think now, you know, I'm scouting. The good thing is I know a lot of people all over the world because I had, I think I had the most teammates of anybody that, you know,
you're welcome everywhere.
Oh, man. I know him. I know him. I know that coach. I remember that coach, or he was the water boy. Now he's the head coach here. Like, you know what I mean? It's crazy.
Yeah. That is cool. That is cool to have a open door everywhere you go, because that's the business. That's the business at the end of the day.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, this was the Pro Ballers segment, but the story you're gonna have to tell is about Venezuela. What you saw was this, because I haven't heard that before. Where players, I mean, you have to fear for your life, honestly.
Yeah, I'm gonna tell you, my first 24 hours in Venezuela. I actually did a YouTube video about it. It's funny, but my first 24 hours. So, like, I get the, I get, you know, I'm talking to my agent, whatever it is, we work the deal out. I'm going to Venezuela after the season. I'm like, cool, I'm about to make some money finally. So, I get on the plane, I go from LA to Atlanta. My flight's delayed leaving Atlanta to go to Caracas. And then it's like 2 hours delayed. Then finally we fly out, get to Caracas. So, like, back then, this is 2011 or whatever. I don't have, my phone doesn't work when I'm overseas or nothing like that. So we land, my bag is late. While I'm waiting for my bag, people coming up to me like, oh, you play basketball? Like, yeah. Like, oh, okay. You American? I'm like, yeah. They're like, hey, look, Venezuela is very dangerous. You know, second most dangerous country in the world. Be careful. Okay. Somebody else come up to me, you play basketball? Like, yeah. They're like, hey, be careful. Venezuela is second most dangerous country in the world. So I'm like, yo, where am I at? Only thing I did was like a Wikipedia search. Like, you know what I mean? Before that, I thought Venezuela was in Africa somewhere. So I'm talking to the lady. Lady don't know where my bag's at. The lady with Delta, she don't know where my bag's at. I'm trying to like look over to the family friends section. I don't see nobody with, you know, a polo or nothing on from the team. So I'm just like, man. So finally somebody radios back and they're like, all right, look, your bag is delayed. They're gonna send it to you tomorrow. Your driver's on the other side. His name is Angel, right? I'm like, all right, cool. So I go to the other side. I don't see nobody with a polo. I just see this dude. He chilling on the rail. He see me. He like, yo. I'm like, what's up, man? He's like, yo, you play for Trotamundos? I'm like, yeah. He's like, all right, look, I'm going to take you to a hotel tonight. You're going to pay for the hotel. And then tomorrow we're going to drive to Valencia because it's a 3-hour drive. And then the team's going to reimburse you for everything. He's like, all right. I'm like, all right, cool. He just starts walking away. I'm like, hey, bro. I'm like, what's your name? He's like, Angel. I'm like, cool. So we get outside. We get to the car. He's not even driving. His homeboy driving. Now I'm like, all right, hold up. So I get it. Keep in mind, like, everybody's been telling me it's the most dangerous city, most dangerous country in the world. I get in the back seat. I don't even take my backpack off. I get in the back seat with it on like this, right? I'm making sure the door is unlocked, like everything. Cause like when you go in Venezuela, it all looks like hood. So at least the areas we were driving in. So I'm just like, yo, if they try to pull into a parking garage, anything, like, I'm jumping out the back seat. Like, I don't care. So I get there. Get to the hotel, get the hotel room, go to sleep, wake up in the morning. Same dudes, he's downstairs with the same outfit on from yesterday. And then a different homeboy comes picks us up. So long story short, we get to the basketball office and the GM's not there. They call the GM. He's like, Anthony, you here? I'm like, yeah. He's like, how you get here? I'm like, Angel brought me. He's like, nah, how'd you get here? I'm like, Angel brought me. He's like, nah. I'm like, I'm staring at Angel right now, bro. He's like, nah, I don't know what's going on, but we'll talk about it later. Hangs up the phone. So now I'm like looking at this dude like, yo, who is this? Like, what is going on? Right. Like, I'm like in the twilight zone. So I go, we got practice later that night. I don't even get dressed. I go straight to the GM. I'm like, yo, bro, what happened? He's like, listen, I don't know if that guy's name was Angel by coincidence, but our driver Angel left because your flight and everything was so delayed. We didn't know where you were. We were calling to the States. You know, you could have been kidnapped, if not worse. And I was just like, yo, so I guess the guy just heard them looking for somebody for a basketball player. And he was just like, yeah, I'll take him. And just did it so he could get paid, you know. But
yeah,
like, I literally got taken 3 hours away in a car with strangers. And you know, kind of like the kidnap capital of South America, man. And it was a crazy time, man. I had teammates that got robbed at gunpoint by a couple 13-year-olds. We seen a knife fight in the stands. Like, the fans will like flash their guns on you, and like none of the police in the stands had guns. They just had shields and stuff. Honestly, I say all that, but I also say that, like, it's dangerous in regards to how you move and stuff like that. But like, the people there are super nice, super fun. Like, it was like the best basketball atmosphere I played in from like a fun standpoint, because if things are going really good for the home team or really bad for the home team, they're throwing beers on the court and then they got to clean it up. Like, you know, things going well, they turn the music up, everybody's dancing. Like, it was a crazy environment, man. It was, it's funny. I was just talking to somebody the other day about Venezuela, man, but I got some good memories out there. But it was just sad to see, like, just how dangerous it was, especially at night, and how you know, you just had to move safely. But it was for sure, man, like the people were great. Still got friends from out there, and the experience of playing basketball out there was really fun.
Yeah, luckily you got good stories to tell. I mean, that's a dangerous encounter there. Yeah, you don't know how it could have ended up.
Nah, for sure. It was crazy. But I remember Justin Dittman was out there when I was there. He got robbed in his apartment. Somebody broke into his apartment and stole like his PlayStation and some other stuff. Like, you would hear like a bunch of stories back then. I've heard the situation has gotten a lot better out there now. And then the second time I went back, it was like even worse in regards to like scarcity. Like, there weren't, you go to the grocery store, you wouldn't find rice. There'd be no milk. There'd be no this. Like, you could literally probably just buy a pack of chicken, and then we'd have to call our owner like, oh, I need rice, I need pasta, I need this and that. And then obviously he's connected. He would have somebody bring it. You just pay him the next day. So, it was sad, man, to see it like around 2015. I think I went back 2016. I went back for a month. But yeah, it was crazy. But I heard it's bounced back, which is good to hear.
Did you have, going from country to country to all these European countries that you went to play, did you have a certain approach or mindset going into the country, or just kind of open to new experiences? You know, because I know I've seen And the first encounter in Germany when I was their assistant coach, I know I remember I was the one picking up guys from the airport because I was most fluent in English, and it was kind of easy way in into a new country, into a new place. Because we used to get rookies, you know, so a rookie comes over, you're going to have to give him a soft landing, you know, having like a little comfortable approach. And then you go to the apartment, the refrigerator is full of food, just kind of ease into the situation, pick him up to the practice and kind of learn the tricks and trades of being overseas. But did you have any early adaptation issues, or did you have an easy adaptation because you were open to culture? Because Kyle Hines also said how he was just kind of talking to Jerome Allen. Jerome just told him, like, look, man, this is just be open to new a different way of living, and it's going to be much easier of having an open mindset and not be closed off and introverted. Go out, talk to people, and just kind of be open to the community that you're in.
Yeah, I mean, I think that having Venezuela as a first stop really opened my eyes to a lot of things. Like, I learned, like, I'm not going to sit here and complain about everything, you know. At least I can walk down the street or, you know, do different things. Like, so by the time I got to Italy and Ukraine and, you know, Israel was a breeze. I mean, Tel Aviv, who wouldn't want to live there? But, you know, by the time I got to other countries, I was open to just adjusting. But I mean, I do remember my first day in Italy. I went to the grocery store and, you know, it's my first day. I didn't have anything in my fridge. So, like, I'm trying to fill it all out. So the lady's scanning, like, you know, 200 euros worth of groceries. You know, in the States, they bag our groceries.
Yeah.
So I'm just sitting there. I'm staring at her. She's looking at me. And I'm like, what's the problem here? And then she holds up a bag like, yo, you need a bag? And I'm like, oh, and I started looking around like, we got to bag our own joint. So I'm like trying to rush, and I know everybody behind me is like, yo, what is wrong with this dude? But I'll never forget that. That was like that was my welcome to Europe moment. I was like, okay, I need to start paying attention. But I like to think of myself as a very attentive person. You know what I mean? I always, you know, when in Rome, I try to, you know, I try to see what everybody else is doing and make sure I'm doing things right. Like, even if I'm eating food, like, I kind of like look around, but like, yo, how I eat this, you know, try to see if anybody else is eating the right way. So, you know, it's just one of those things. But I invite, you know, kind of the novelty of living in different places nowadays. And I never really had a problem with it. I had a problem with service. So, like, in Europe, you need your Wi-Fi cut on, you need something fixed or whatever. It is so slow. Like, that used to kill me. Like, don't have me in here without Wi-Fi or heat or AC or whatever it is. You know what I mean? Like, that used to kill me because it used to take days and days and days just to get stuff done. And that part I did not like, and I was not willing to adjust. I was very frustrated with that, but everything else is cool.
Yeah, those things are usually out of the club's control, but that's also on them to do it earlier. You know, just to have that set up already when the player arrives, because they know the apartment. I mean, I don't know. It's every club, every country is different too. So I can't have a, you know,
right,
exactly, the whole hub. So it's about in Spain, it took me 3 months to get my internet. it took me forever. By the time they called me, I was like, I'm out. I'm done. I'm going back to I was, at that time, I went back to Lithuania, but I was heated.
Yeah, that's the worst, bro. Internet's like air these days.
Yeah, back then I didn't have it, so I had to go to this cafe. I was in Gavà, outside of Barcelona. I had to go to this cafe to download my games. And the guy there, I was trying to be nice too. I was trying to talk a little bit Spanish, and that's about, you know, it's you better, if I could have impressed if I learned Catalan maybe. And he was not having it at all. He never cracked a smile. He saw just me there with a laptop and drinking my Cortado, and he didn't allow me to charge my laptop while I was working. So by the time I had to download the games, because by the time the battery drained, I had to go home, charge my battery. They had siesta. Then I come back in the afternoon. Hey, I'm back again. Hey, that was my lifestyle in Gavà, just downloading games at the cafe with an angry barista.
That's tough.
What's going into retirement or approaching retirement, and then going out of the basketball identity, the basketball player identity? Was there certain behaviors after being pro or playing basketball for 15 years, including Stanford, So like, was there certain behaviors you had to unlearn? Is there something that a mind shift had to occur for you to get used to a normal life or a normal person's life and have a realizing that you have to have a different approach with people maybe? Or is there something that you had to unlearn in terms of controlling your emotions better? Because on the court, we allow to let our emotions go a lot of times, you know? So there's some kind of restrained when you get off the court. Then was there some sort of behaviors you had to unlearn and restructure your lifestyle?
Yeah, food portions was the first thing I had to unlearn, because you quickly forget that, like, when basketball is your job every day, you're running on the court at least 2 hours a day, sometimes 4 hours a day. That's like essentially working out, sweating, burning calories. Eat whatever you want, you're fine, right? So when I retired and I'm back home, I'm, you know, going on a little jog for like an hour, you know, and doing my push-ups and stuff. And I was still eating the same. But so I started putting on weight and I'm just like, man, I'm working out every day. Like, what's going on? And then I started to realize, like, I can't eat the same way that, you know, either I got to eat less or I got to work out more. And so I had to find that balance, because as an athlete, you know, you get used to seeing yourself a certain way. You get used to seeing your body a certain way. And then, you know, I'm doing switch cultures and, you know, I'm in the gym with all these players and stuff. And like, you see them and they're in shape and they're working out every day, just kind of like you were just doing, you know what I'm saying? So then you kind of get like a complex, like, yo, like, nah, like, I'm not that far removed. Like, I should still be in shape. So that was one thing for me. But I think retiring in general, and as I've talked to other athletes that are in the process of transitioning or have already transitioned, I always say nothing's going to replace that feeling of playing. Like, just forget it. Like, you're never going to replace that feeling. You know what I'm saying? Go get in the men's league. Go do what you got to do. You're never going to replace that feeling, though. So don't look for a job that's going to replace that feeling. Like, you know, look for a job that, you know, A, is centered around something you love and you have some form of passion behind it. And then, you know, just try to pick up the pieces to get as close to that feeling as possible, but you're never going to reach it. And you got to be okay with that. And that's the part, the tough part is just feeling like, okay, I'm going to be okay with that. You know, so I think that, yeah, man, it's extremely difficult, man. And a lot of people, I always thought, like, the day I retired, I'm going to cry. I'm going to lock myself in the house. The day I decide, like, I'm done, I'm going to lock myself in the room. I'm not going to talk to nobody. It's going to be an emotional day, all this other stuff. And like, it wasn't. And I never really had that like emotional moment. Like, dang, like, it's really, I didn't really realize it was over until I went to go scout a practice. And I saw the guys, like the players, you know, joking around during stretching and, you know, talking trash to each other. Like, that's when I missed it. I missed the camaraderie. That's when I was like, dang, I'm really on the other side. Like, I'm sitting in the bleachers, like, you know, and I was just like, dang, it's really over. But yeah, outside of that, I mean, every now and then, you know, you get flashes like, man, I wish I was still playing. Or you see like a friend, like I just talked to my friend, one of my old teammates yesterday, he's 39 and still hooping. And I was just like, dang, man, like, that's, it's a beautiful thing, especially our generation is playing longer and longer at a higher level, you know, because of the modalities and everything else that's surrounded recovery in the last 10 to 15 years. But yeah, I mean, but, you know, you start your second life. They say athlete lives two lives, you know, has two deaths, you know, one when he retires and then one when he dies. But, you know, just finding your second career. And I think the cool part is, once you get into your second career, you're not as emotionally attached to it. So I feel like it's easier to kind of stay flexible and be open to new things and learning new things and stuff like that. Because, because it's a fresh start, but you got to be a rookie again.
I totally agree with you that part, that there's nothing that's going to be replacing those emotions on the court. I had two chapters, a player chapter and a coaching chapter, which I still can enjoy with the national team. And the emotional part, you it's unreplaceable even as on the coaching staff. Like you can't replace that what you experience on the court because of that, the involvement, the adrenaline, the physicality, the, everything that you kind of went through, the battles, the physical battles, and you overcome those, and the victory that you feel inside of you with your peers, it's something that's second to none. And the adrenaline rush, it's kind of, I mean, you get dependent on the hormonally. I mean, I'm not trying to get scientific here, but it is hormonal. So there is a lot of guys that struggle with that when they don't have the perspective to really change their mind in terms of having a different approach and put that to the side, because that was a whole different realm. You're not gonna, that's something that you can't find in regular life. And finding a passion, finding a new passion. And once I got also out of that 24/7 coaches bubble where I was in the video room and bunker all the time, I went and did this job. This job exposed me to a whole lot of different new facets of life. And that is what's intriguing. Then you also have to make sure that you kind of can dial it back at some point and refocus on your job, because there's so many more interesting things out there that I want to absorb, that I want to learn. That you, when we were hanging out in Senegal and went to one of our trips, it's just kind of like you said, you see content everywhere. And that's what we transitioning to, into switch cultures and into just podcasting, into different hobbies that become a passion, that become also another part, another job that you have on the side, which is also, you know, it's where your emotions are attached to. You find content, you realize that this is interesting, this is the creative part of you, because some part of our regular jobs is not as creative. It's just observing, evaluating, and the other part is where you can creatively express yourself. So I'm wondering, first of all, how you go about with Swish Cultures, with two podcasts, right? You have two podcasts going at the same time. You have a YouTube channel. There's a lot of things that you have to structure in your head. You have to have the bandwidth. But if you have the passion, I think the bandwidth automatically is going to be expanded anyways. So how do you deal with those different parts of your creative life? And how do you combine those different parts at the same time while not losing focus on the main thing in your job?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the creative side, like this is essentially like watching TV for me. And I think like Switch Cultures, it kind of aligns with, you know, everything else I'm doing. I mean, my life is centered around basketball. So it's like, if I'm watching a game, I'm watching TJ Shorts last night, you know, I'm watching the game for whatever reason. I could sit there and be like, oh man, he had a couple nice plays. I can put that up on Switch Cultures tomorrow. Like, you know, and that just makes it that much easier for me. I don't have to skim through 100 box scores and see who might have had a good game and look through their clips and all that other stuff. You know what I'm saying? So, yeah, man, I think there's the creative side. I mean, I've just always been a creative in general. So I always need to do something creative. I don't care if it's sketching, writing, rapping, whatever it is. Like, you know what I mean? I just like to create, and just that's my fun. That's my TV. I don't watch TV. So it's like,
me neither.
Anything.
We're like the same. I don't watch TV.
I don't watch TV, man. So it's like, because I feel like, when I watch TV, I'm sitting down and I'm watching somebody else's creation. It's not like I watch it for like inspiration, and somebody's like, oh, this was dope or this was good or whatever it is. I'll watch it then. But it's like, you know, I'd rather not just watch it. So I'd rather create, you know what I mean? So, yeah, man, I think the creation part is key. Cause I think too, like when you're scouting, like you don't really have a lot of impact. You know what I mean? You don't have a lot of impact that you can control. Like you're very much, your job is essentially kind of black and white. There's not like a lot of room for creativity. You can't make this guy make 8 shots when he made 6, or, you know what I mean? Whatever it is, you could give your opinion. And I think that's where the lines of your creativity are drawn. But, you know, it's not very like impactful. Like, okay, if I write this about, you know, somebody, my opinion here is going to change the entire season or whatever, you know what I mean? But I think that, you know, when you create, or you know, you like you had the podcast with Boris Diaw and he tells you something crazy that you've never heard before. Like, that's dope. And then the whole basketball world sees it and like, no way. You know what I mean? It's like,
that was crazy, man.
That was impactful though. That's impactful. Like, yeah. And it's like, had you not had the podcast or whatever it is, like who knows when we would have heard this story or if we would have even heard it in English or, you know what I mean? There's just so many what ifs. So, you know, that's where I say that, like, I think coupling our job with the creative side, I think is really cool because, you know, we're blessed in the sense that we get to go to a lot of different places, meet a lot of different people from different cultures and pretty much just comb through the entire basketball world. You know what I mean? From agents to front office, to coaches, to players, like all that, you know what I mean? We really get to take it all in. And then, you know, we use our creative juices to kind of, you know, fish that out to the world. So, you know, I think there's a lot to love about, you know, combining the creative with, you know, your day job, but it does take a lot of time. And then sometimes depending on, you know, your bandwidth, sometimes you do get on E. Like last night I was on E, you know, I was tired. By the end of the day, I had so many calls and stuff. By the end of the day, I was cooked, but, you know, you get your rest in the next day's the next day.
And that's when sleep comes in, my man. Mm-hmm. You gotta get that sleep right too, man.
Nah, for sure. I mean, yeah, you definitely got to do that. You definitely got to sleep, man. I think people underrate sleep, but yeah, I got sleep apps and everything. I try to get like hypnotized so I can sleep. You know, so I can't do it on my own.
Let me ask you this about the because there's a lot of drive that we have not naturally also as former athletes if you were in a professional sports environment, you naturally are driven, so that also translates into what you do with the creative part, with Switch Cultures, with that, with the podcast, with everything. You have a drive, right? We all have like a sense of accomplishment that we want to achieve, that there's something there. How much is that sense of accomplishment that you drive for and you strive for versus stress and something, a fear of failure within it? Is there a competition within the competition for you, or are you just naturally, does that come to you easily when you watch it, you see the content that you can create and you don't really stress yourself out for it? Or is that something that you use as motivation to drive the brand even further up?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you look at the landscape and you see, you know, other things that people are doing, you know, remarkably, you do want to kind of create something on that level. It's funny because now that I'm doing what I'm doing, I remember as a kid, I used to love commercials. If you asked me what I wanted to be, probably when I was around like 11 years old, I was like, I want to make commercials. I used to get so excited for the Super Bowl just for the commercial because I was just like, yo, it's like a 30-minute movie or a 30-second movie or a 30-second joke. Like, you know what I mean? And I thought it was so cool. And you know, I saw, look at this commercial, like, oh, that didn't move me, or that was a really good one, or whatever. And then I kind of lost that thought. And, you know, once I got into media, my thing was, especially in Europe, I was just like, I'm so sick of having to answer, oh, I want to be the first one in, the last one out, or I care about the team. I got tired of answering like that, and I got tired of hearing other people answer the same way. Like, I got sick of watching the interview, and then you're like, okay, you know exactly what he's going to say. Oh, it's not about me. It's about the team. It's like, nah, yeah, I had 20 points. They could not guard me tonight, and I hope I can do it again tomorrow. Like, you know what I mean? I hope they watch these highlights. Like, that's what I really want to say, but, you know, okay. I'm gonna put the athlete hat on and be humble. Like, nah, that's not what we're saying in the locker room.
No,
you know what I'm saying? That's why we gotta say this now. And that's where it's like, I look at Switch Cultures, and you know, anybody can argue with me if they want, but I feel like, you know, we speak the language of the locker room, you know what I mean, in regards to media companies. And and partly because, you know, I played, and you know, my partner played, and other partner was an athlete as well. So it's just like, I feel like we are like the voice of the locker room in a sense, in regards to media companies. Cause you know, I'm just sick. I was sick of like the cookie cutter media stuff. And, you know, I just wanted to kind of do something different. So, and I'm glad because I feel like we are. And I think that's why we have our own little cult following. And yeah, and we put out unique content that that we don't see. But yeah.
It ain't a little following. You're being humble. It ain't a little following.
It's funny because I've always said that, like, you know, my partners, I felt like sometimes in some of our conversations, I always felt like they think we're bigger than we are. I think we're smaller than we are. And the truth is in the middle. You know what I mean? And I think that the reason that is because they're in LA and they're around a whole bunch of creatives. You know, the creative network in LA is huge. And like, they're around people that recognize the content and stuff like that. Whereas we're not as big in Europe. So I go out, nobody's going to recognize me or anything like that. Sometimes I get recognized in the States and, you know, especially if I got like a Swiss shirt on or something, but, you know, so it's like, I think because of that, like my mentality is still very much like it was when I was in France and I put the first two videos up, you know what I'm saying? It's just like, we have zero followers. Like, how are we going to get to 10 followers? You know? So it's like, it's beautiful to see what we've grown to, but, and we've never paid for followers. We never like, you know, did any of that stuff. We grew organically and I think that was the right way to go about things. And, you know, I'm very proud of where we are and I'm excited to see, you know, what could be, you know, the next step for us.
Yeah, no, it's as organic as it gets. And you see that the following is just organic because everybody's on there. It's our basketball fanatics, you know, and that's what it's for. What, before we go into the ATOs, because we're winding up here, but what was the first seed for Swish Cultures? Where did that originally come? How did it come about? Well, who planted the first seed?
Yeah, so my partner Jordan, who we played together in Dominican Republic. So before Swish Cultures, I had a podcast that I was doing, right? And then he was putting up his own highlights from, like, he was working out and stuff and filming himself and putting up highlights. And I thought it was corny at the time because nobody was doing it at the time. So like, it was preseason that season in 2017. He called me. He's like, "Hey, bro, we should do a highlights for overseas basketball players." I was like, "Yeah, it's a good idea." He was like, "Cause he was like, you know how to edit?" I was like, "Not really, but I'll figure it out." And then that day, man, I just got on YouTube, downloaded the program, and the first two videos went up. It was Charles Cahuti and Eloy Vargas. In France, they played against each other. Those are the first two Swish videos ever. I think Eloy might have been first, but those are the first two Swish videos ever. So
that is cool.
Yeah, started back then, and then, you know, we just moved on from there. Charles still playing though, man. It's crazy.
Yeah, he is. He is.
Yo, I had a question for you though, man.
Shoot.
So if there was, let's just say that there was a player, and he's thinking about okay, I'm either going to go into scouting or coaching. Having been on both sides, how would you direct somebody to go to one side or the other?
That's a very good question. I think if early on, I think you should maximize if you want to stay close to the court, you want to stay close to the locker room, you want to have people around you, and you are more of a social person that needs that team environment, you should stick with coaching for a little bit longer, just to stick around the game and give your information, pass that information along to the staff that you experienced as a player. And, you know, you'll find out if you want to coach or not along the way. I think it's easier to transition from coaching into scouting off the court and then go into that realm and then be maybe transition back into management than it is to go out and be out of the team environment, be in scouting, and then just kind of go back into coaching. It's a tougher transition, I think. So as a player, if you are finishing up, I would suggest to, if you can't decide between the two, because there's other options out there too, but if you can't decide between the two, I would suggest to stick around the team a little bit longer and be in a coaching staff and be around and feel if you really are wanting to doing, if you want to do the video work, if you want to be in around the staff and you want to, because it's a different regime than it is for a player. So not all players are in tune and want to have that office time all the time. You have to have a lot of meetings with the coaching staff. You got to go through a lot of different situations. You have to be absolutely passionate about the topics. The pick and roll defense is going to be number one discussion. If you get tired of talking about the pick and roll defense after 2 weeks, that might not be for you. So you got to go through that, experience it, and know if you have the passion, the energy for it, and to go through that 10 months of a year. Because, you know, if you're not doing national team, you're going to have 10 months of that completely dialed in intensity. And it's a different level of intensity than it is. But players have a different level. I'm not saying either one is bigger, but it's a different kind of intensity. And then you have to have learned understanding for what the head coach is going through. I've never been a head coach before, but as an assistant coach, you kind of feel the tension, the pressure that he's going through. And then it's interesting, and you can be a providing helping hand to kind of calm the waters a little bit within the locker room. And there's a lot more dynamics within the coach's locker room and within the locker room in itself, being close to the team, because as a contrary to the scouting side. In the scouting side, you kind of come in, you observe, you're in a stance, like you said earlier, you evaluate, you get information, you talk to the coaches on a very casual basis, and it also depends on the day they're having. And then you're out, you know, you're doing your own thing. You're completely away from that bubble. That's a completely different bubble you're living in. And it's hard to transition from the scouting bubble to the coach's bubble and vice versa. I think that's the feel I have doing that. And I'm lucky to be able to do both, because then the transition becomes easier. But I felt it mm-hmm. when there was a longer break. Now we have the window, so it's a little bit easier to go, you know, from scouting to coaching after a year of just scouting around and traveling. And, you know, it was also tough. I've got some players when they retire. It's also tough when I went out of the coaching, full-time coaching into scouting, full-time scouting. And then you kind of seeing your guys on TV, like you went through the battles with them. You see them what am I doing here? You know, I'm completely out of it. I'm supposed to be right there. So it took a little while to transition, and that was the tougher part. But that's why I would suggest for players to stick around a little bit longer and kind of figure out if you having to say no is also important. Like knowing when to say no, feeling mm-hmm. that you really that put that check mark on there. I tried it, and it's not going to be for me. So, and then you can move on.
That's interesting. That's a good point. It's a really good point.
So you ready for my ATOs?
Let's get it. You
almost survived my whole podcast here. So, all right, quick come and go here. Funniest follow on Twitter or X or whatever you want to call it.
Funniest follow? Man, it's funny. I go to Twitter, man, just for, Mike Hall. Mike Hall,
Mike
for sure.
Hall. Okay.
Yeah, Mike Hall for sure. He's crazy. He's wild. He's a former teammate of mine. But if you're not following Mike Hall, I don't even know what his handle is, like Michaelino or something like that. But Mike is I think he's trying to like climb up the coaching ranks, so he's tweeting less, which is good for him because his mouth will get him in trouble. But Mike by far.
All right. What tabs are open in your browser right now?
What's what?
Tabs. What tabs are open in your browser?
Oh man, Google, downloading YouTube videos, Google again. It's my email, Google search, and like downloading YouTube videos because I'm a pirate.
As you see, I updated my ATO question, so I'm putting people more on the spot here.
All right.
In a room with anyone you ever met, who would you look for?
I probably look for my dad. You know, my dad passed when I was 12, and I feel like there would just be a lot of questions, especially as an adult. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I felt like I missed that part of the relationship, and I think that yeah, he'd probably be the first person I look for, and then my mom. But you know, I talk to my mom every day. We could talk another day.
Box of everything you've ever lost. What is the first thing you look for?
Man, my passport. Then I wouldn't have had to fly to Miami. Nah, man, everything I ever lost. Man, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I had a crazy situation where I lost my house in Corona, and I'm not going to get into the details of how it happened because it wasn't my fault, but I felt like that was so devastating to me because that was like the one thing I had from my playing career that like, okay, this was what all the running, all the everything, you know, all the everything I went through, I felt like this was symbolic of that, you know what I'm saying? And yeah, finding out that everything had transpired the way it did and just the mess with the lawyers and all that other stuff, like that was like, it was tough to get over, but I felt like that was like the one thing where I was just like, damn, like, and on the bright side, bought another house in August this past year. So, you know, it's kind of like getting my backpack stolen and getting a new camera and getting a new iPhone and passport. Like, you know, you know, you're going to replace things that you lose, but it's always the things that are symbolic. So like, even when I lost my backpack a couple of weeks ago, like the thing that emotionally I was tied to the most was I had like a rose gold chain in there. And that was like, I was never really into jewelry that much, but like that was something recently that I bought like a couple years ago that I was like, all right, because I never really buy myself anything. I was like, I'm gonna buy this for myself. So It was like the chain in the house were like two things that like I bought that I was just I had some emotional attachment to. And so like losing those two things were kind of like probably a little more, you know, tougher to get over than everything else.
But I bet.
Usually I'm kind of cool with things getting lost.
I bet. Yeah. It sounds like emotional experience there.
Mm-hmm.
Chance to relive one day of your life. Which day would that be? A whole day?
Man. Chance to live a whole day.
Relive.
Relive a whole day. You know, I think it will be the day that I got into Stanford, that I got the acceptance letter. And I didn't care today. I'm very nonchalant, like happy go. Like I got in, I was like, oh, cool. My mom obviously was super excited. And I look back at that moment as probably, you know, the most precious moment in my life that obviously I didn't realize it back then. But like for her, like having to raise me by myself for most of those years, take me to practices, make sure I do my homework, all that other stuff. And then, you know, she came from the South and, you know, obviously segregation and, you know, she had to walk through the back of buildings and blacks weren't allowed to eat vanilla ice cream, just like all this stuff that she had to go through and just keeping a black kid alive. And then for him to get into Stanford, I know she was just, you know, head above the clouds. And I wish I could relive that day to really take that moment in and enjoy it with her, because I know when she told me, she gave me a hug and a kiss, I'm like, all right, mom, get off me, like, you know, and went back to, you know, watching the Laker game or something. But
yeah,
you know, I wish I would have took that moment in a little more, because I know it was probably special for her.
That is cool for you to realize that, to reflect on that, because of everything. Mm-hmm. Everything. I mean, I can sense that's a really big importance to your mom, and that's mm-hmm. something. It's really cool that you can reflect on that and remember that, and put all those things into words, and then put it into perspective.
Yeah, you know, as you get older, you just see things that happen, whether it be sacrifices from your parents or a teacher or whatever it is. You start seeing like the little things that were so much more important than you even had a clue back then.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying?
And so, you know, in retrospect, man, you know, I think everybody has a couple of those moments, you know.
And some people don't mature to that point where they can reflect upon that and see, you know, mm-hmm. kind of admit to certain things that they should have done different. And that's when they don't grow. That's the bottom line of it.
Yeah, that's a fact.
So the last one, top three things, events, or experiences left on your bucket list?
Experiences left on my bucket list, man. I want to go to Brazil, but I'm going for BWB. Brazil's just always been on my bucket list. I don't know why. I'll say that's one. I think another two would be, man, I really don't know. I think anything I really want to do. Okay. So I've been working on, an animation series for years about like the craziest stories that have happened to professional athletes. And I've literally been working on this thing probably about 7-8 years now.
Wow.
And if that thing ever makes the light of day, and I'm talking about like on a big streaming channel or something like that, that would be a bucket list moment for me. And and I think like the last thing for me would just be to do something else impactful in the basketball world. You know what I mean? I felt like Swish Cultures was, you know, nobody was really doing highlights of players. It was always team oriented. And now, you know, there's multiple channels and pages and stuff like showcasing overseas highlights for basketball players. So I felt like, you know, we were the first in that lane and we kind of started that wave and made it cool. And now other people are starting to do that. And I'm glad like we left our stamp on that. And, you know, I really want to do something else. I'm not sure what that is, but I really want to do something else that's going to make the basketball world better and more inclusive, you know, both sides, America and, you know, overseas. So I don't know what that is yet, but that would be another bucket list thing. I'm not done creating. So I gotta create one more thing.
I wish you all the best. I wish you all the best.
I appreciate it.
If you need help with creation, let me know. I got some ideas too.
Nah, for sure, man. You know what I mean? I'll just fire up. I'll bring the coffee beans. You know what I mean? We'll just sit down and hammer it out.
That's another creation of mine that's gonna come up. Benison beans. That's gonna be the coffee channel, Benison Beans, because the autocorrect for Benos is beans.
Oh, that's real. Okay, I like it. I like it. That's creative. Yeah. Yo, real quick, I saw Kenny Smith. He said in like an interview that he was sleeping on the plane next to this lady, and this lady was like, "Look, don't sleep on the plane because of the oxygen or whatever."
Yeah.
You saw that, right?
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
That's
yeah.
when you're most creative. Do you believe that?
No. No, I don't. I don't believe. Sometimes the air pressure gets to me, and then I get tired, and I take a nap. I think it's the moment. It's a moment thing. I don't think that's something that's can scientifically be proven. That's when the creation aligns and the neurons start firing. And I feel like creation is a spur of the moment. Like sometimes you get the most inspiring and the best ideas in the stillest moments, and in the shower, mm-hmm. on the toilet, and when on a train when you don't have music on, you just kind of in your own zone and not doing nothing. That's when something happens, and that's when your brain cells are not distracted. That's when you're mostly in tune with yourself, and I think that's when the most ideas come along. I don't think that a plane or the air pressure or like. Now, if you want to sleep, you sleep, man. It's going to give you some rest, and that might inspire you to. That might give you some energy. That's a power nap that you might need for that moment. So, I don't feel like that's true. I mean, she got to show me some like 100 studies that prove that.
But I mean, there are less stimulants on an airplane than like
So it depends what you do. Yeah, there is less stimulants, but there is, then you don't have your AirPods on or whatever, because mm-hmm. then I just automatically revert to working, and that's it's obviously you're on a plane, and then you can get stuff done. But yeah, there's still if you just take off the AirPods, you don't look at the iPad, and you just kind of let your thoughts flow, then yeah, maybe something is going to come along. But that you can do the same thing in a train and an Uber ride. It's not plane specific, you know, like there has to be some chemical reaction just because you're in that high of an altitude. So that I don't know if that can be correlated.
I don't know. I got to do some searching. I'll let you know.
How can people find you? Let everyone know how they can find you. Swish Cultures, obviously. Swish Cultures.
Yeah, Swish Cultures at swishcultures.com. I'm on Instagram at AntGoods, AntGoods 87. And then Twitter is just at AntGoods. So that's where I'm at, man. And I need to get a website and stuff, you know, start keeping everything on one little hub so I can just be go to here.com, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But Yeah, I need to. That's gonna be my next project.
Check out my website and maybe you get some inspiration there. I got a pod map on there.
Okay.
Where should I pin you on that pod map?
I'm in Madrid, baby.
Okay, that's gonna be the Anthony Goods pin.
Yeah, that's where I'm at, man. This is where I'm at right now until further notice.
Okay. All right. We'll do that. All right, Anthony. Appreciate it very much. It's been a blast.
Appreciate you. All right, dog.
Thanks a lot. See you soon.
Yes, sir.